Good evening and welcome. We're delighted to host Shane Hipps this evening for an ongoing conversation to gather around this theme, the spirituality of the cell phone, reclaiming your soul in the digital age. Shane Hipps is lead pastor of Trinity Mennonite Church, a missional urban Anabaptist congregation in Phoenix, Arizona, where he lives with his family. Before receiving a Master of Divinity degree at Fuller Theological Seminary and later accepting a call as pastor, he was a strategic planner in advertising, where he worked on a multi-million dollar communications plan for Porsche. And it was in that role that he gained expertise in understanding media and culture. Shane is a sought-after speaker, a contributor to Leadership Journal, host of Third Way Faith podcast on wiredparish.com, and author of two books. First of all, The Hidden Power of Electronic Culture, How Media Shapes Faith, the Gospel, and the Church, and the book that is released now, Flickering Pixels, How Technology Shapes Your Faith. We welcome you, Shane. We look forward to learning from you and having some exchange with you. And let's welcome Shane Hipps to Harrisonburg and Eastern Mennonite University.
So first of all, how about the inauguration? Did everybody see that? Was that not amazing? I mean, I don't care how you voted, but that's amazing. That was deeply moving. So I'm glad I'm following up that big event. Kind of a downer now, but that's all right. So one of the things that I wanted to introduce you to was my immoral past. I thought I would offer by way of confession my sin. And the way I will do that is when I worked in advertising, I had to... Part of my job was to understand consumers and their mindset, and then find ways to inhabit your imagination and hijack it, and then feed you opinions that you thought were your own. That was my job, and I'm proud of that. And I have with me a little piece of propaganda that I didn't write, but I was involved in strategically creating. So this is one of the branding pieces that we did for Porsche. You wouldn't have seen it on TV because it's about 3 minutes long, but it gives you a feel for exactly what it is that I did. And again, you will, by the end of this, you'll probably want to run right out and buy a Porsche. This would have been shown at like the Detroit Auto Show or like some big, huge gathering to like demonstrate the brand, every part of kind of what it is and what makes it amazing. And so let me just give you a taste of that. And that's my confession, and then we'll dive into our topic for this evening. And the only reason I'm sharing this with you is just pure human interest, but also because it was my career in advertising that exposed me to how people are shaped and changed and what influences them. And I discovered in my time there, among other things, technology was one of those things that gets overlooked that shapes who we are. So...
What would the world be like if everything had to be practical? Would there be a place for cotton candy or amusement parks? What would the world be like if composers were told to be more efficient and poets had to keep to the facts? And in this world, where would we live? How would we live? What would give us joy? And the car? Would the cars give us joy? Or would they too only be built to satisfy a need? What would the world be like if everything had to be practical? What would happen to men with dreams? Crazy, impossible, unbelievably impractical dreams. Of building something that no one has said they need. What would the world be like if everything had to be rational? Would there be room for a dreamer? Would there be room for a company of dreamers? A place where inspiration comes not just once, but again, and again, and again. And where everything they build is a culmination of everything they know, and everything they are. It's time, once again, to look around and be thankful that we live in the world that we do, and that there are companies like Porsche that build cars like these, that allow little boys and the rest of the world to dream, as impractical, irrational, and unnecessary as that may be. Introducing the new 911 Turbo from Porsche. Here's to the dreamers.
How evil am I, huh? Isn't that great? I mean, that's like an anti-Mennonite treaty right there. Like, how would we live if everything had to be practical and simple? Wouldn't it be a catastrophic life? Thank God there are people like Porsche that allow little boys and the rest of the world to dream. Oh, brilliant. So anyway, you can see there where I started to have a little bit of moral sense of conflict of interest between what I think the gospel is about and maybe what I was spending 70 hours a week trying to promote. You with me? Do you see what's going on? So anyway, that was just for fun. The thing that I want to focus on, though, right now and this evening is the often overlooked connection between our spirituality and our technology. So the simplest way to put this is that our technological diet shapes our souls as much as our food diet shapes our bodies. These two things are connected, and this connection is almost always overlooked. So, in a way, what I'll be talking about tonight is the spirituality of technology in general. And I entitled it The Spirituality of the Cell Phone because the cell phone is basically a perfect metaphor for all of the convergence of the digital age. I mean, is there anything a cell phone can't do these days? This gentleman here was showing me that he had the lighter on his iPhone, right? Like, that's awesome. Does it actually light like a cigarette or anything? Or is it, it's not real. Okay, well, in any case. So the cell phone, I think, is this perfect metaphor for the aggregate of the entire digital age because it contains pretty much every medium that is out there right now. And what is interesting is that there is a bias embedded in our digital age. There is a spirituality, a way that we are being shaped without our knowledge or permission. So that's one part of what I'll mention. The other thing I'll just allude to tonight is also the technology of spirituality. And that is those techniques, methods, and practices that help us expand, evolve, and deepen our spiritual lives. And so we'll explore that together. First of all, God made all of us in his image. Every one of us in this room is an image bearer of God. God created us that way. And one of the things that means, among a lot of things, is that we are creators. If God is a creator and that is his image and we are made in his image, that means we are also creators. You with me? Follow me? Co-creators. In fact, we can't not create. That's how much that kind of impulse is baked into us as humans. Whether that's a human child, whether that's clothing, whether that's a piece of art, whether that's some new idea. We are constantly generating new things, creating. And what goes unnoticed is that our current digital age is simply the aggregate of 10,000 years of human creativity, of human ingenuity. Everything about this complex age we live in is the culmination of millennia of creativity. So everything you see is actually part of being image bearers of God. Now here's the deal. When God created, he called it good. In the same way, when we create, these are good things for the most part. But the funny thing is, even God's self, when he created, there was an unintended consequence to what he created. He did not anticipate he didn't anticipate the fall. Maybe he knew about it, but he certainly didn't want it. The fall. So there's this unintended consequence of this good creation, there was a fall. So all of the creative energy and all the ingenuity and all of the technology that you see, I believe, are inherently expressions of our goodness and expressions of our creativity, and they have an unintended consequence. So what I'm interested in doing is just showcasing a couple of those unintended consequences, and then we'll have room for discussion if you want to discuss, and if you don't, no problem. But that's what we're going to talk about. So let me give you an example of one of those inventions and its unintended consequence. Can anybody tell me who invented the mechanical clock? Anyone? It was invented in about the 13th century by Benedictine monks. Anyone know why they invented it? Boom! Bingo! To pray the hours. So Benedictine monks developed this thing. They basically said, how do we get more regular and more frequent prayers in our day? The day kind of gets away from us. How are we going to monitor that? How are we going to measure that? How are we going to divide out the day so that we get our prayers in? And they developed this remarkable thing called the mechanical clock that regularly marked time. And sure enough, remarkably, these Benedictines who developed it to enhance their prayer life, it worked. Here's the odd thing. It had an unintended consequence. The mechanical clock gave birth to something else. What's known today as the Industrial Revolution. This capacity, this incredible capacity to divide the day into discrete, uniform, measurable units, created the very conditions necessary for mass production on an extraordinary scale. And suddenly, people could produce things at very efficient rates, and they could produce them on a mass scale because they had a clock. So what that means is the clock, this, by the way, was the precursor to consumer culture. What that means is the clock, which was originally designed to enhance our devotion to God, actually became something that enhanced our devotion to money. God and mammon. The two were in competition. The very thing that somebody created, the technology, had an unintended consequence, or you might say, the spirituality of the clock became the spirituality of money, of mammon. And so today we have this strange marriage. These two things became paired and related, intimately tied together. You've heard the phrase, time is money. So suddenly our age, with the introduction, thanks to these Benedictine monks, have created this fever-pitched race for more time and more money. And because of this extraordinary pairing of these two things, it created and introduced a new kind of suffering in our world. It's a very low-level suffering. It's a chronic kind of suffering. You all experience it all the time. You probably don't even notice it as suffering. It is the race for more time and the fear that you don't have enough of it. Time is suddenly this burning, incinerating furnace that is destroying every moment of your life, and you must race to outrun it. Deadlines drop like wrecking balls, and you are tense, racing, hoping for more hours in the day. By the way, that's unique to our culture. Not all cultures feel that way about time. Many cultures that never use the mechanical clock simply don't have an ambivalent or anxious or antagonistic relationship to time. It isn't something that lords over them. It's just something that is part of the rhythm of life. And it unfolds as it needs to unfold. But for us, it's a kind of suffering. Now, fortunately, because we are creative beings, we go about creating things to respond to the demand and suffering that is going on. To ease our suffering, we create things that will help us respond to the demands of this. And so much of our digital age is a direct consequence and response to the suffering created by the clock being married with money. What happens is a new kind of human emerges in response to this. And I'm going to introduce you to that breed of species.
Life is busy, but some people seem to get more done than others. Multitaskers. And when the Palm Central was designed, Sprint thought of these people. Then we gave it Sprint speed. You can email, text, chat, go online so fast.
People may wonder how many of you there really are.
Introducing the Palm Central, only from Sprint, for just $99.99 on the fastest national mobile broadband network. Multitask at Sprint speed.
So, here you have an ad from Sprint that introduces a new species. And I love the way this guy describes it. He talks about this new breed of people. He's got like this, his voice is dripping with like the nerdy enthusiasm of a marine biologist who's just discovered some new species, you know? We call them multitaskers. Ooh, fascinating. So here you have this remarkable ad. I worked in advertising. One of the things I learned about advertising is all good ads tell a truth. If they were not telling a truth, you would not buy the products. I also learned that all really good ads tell a lie. If you did not tell the lie, you wouldn't listen to what we were saying. In this ad are embedded a truth and a lie. Can anyone tell me what the truth of this ad is? Okay, people are busy. Good. What else is true about the ad? What's true about the product?
It's helpful.
Yeah, how's it helpful? Yeah, it makes you more efficient, right? If it didn't, you wouldn't buy it. We wouldn't have billions of dollars cell phone industry if it didn't actually make your life a little bit more convenient. If it didn't actually allow you to do multiple things at once and therefore have more hours in your day, in theory, right? Are you with me? You're aware of this as a truth. Can anyone tell me what the lie in the ad was? This one's a little more subtle. Take a crack at it. Or you could just sit there. Okay, I'll tell you what I think the lie in the ad is. The lie in this ad is brilliant. It's not found in anything the guy says. The lie is found in the imagery. Let me show you that one more time. Sorry. Still learning how to use this. Watch the imagery.
Life is busy, but some people seem to get more done than others. Multitaskers. And when the Palm Central was designed, Sprint thought of these people. Then we gave it Sprint speed. You can email, text, chat, go online so fast.
People may wonder how many of you there really are.
Introducing the Palm Central.
Okay. What is the gag? What's the ad? I mean, you've got basically these people who have clones, right? And they've got little hobbit-sized clones that are running around doing things at the same time. You're multitasking. People may wonder how many of you there really are. Here's what's remarkable about this ad. If it were telling the truth visually, it would actually have the original person the same size as the hobbits. Because what multitasking does, we have discovered, is that it does not multiply you, it divides you. Now, this is not new wisdom. First century Roman slave said to do two things at once is to do neither. First century Chinese parable, chase two rabbits, catch none. The simplicity of the first century understood that multitasking was not all it's cracked up to be. Now, what we learned actually is, through scientific research in our 20th century, is that if you actually do research on brain functioning when people are engaged in multitasking, here's what happens. You actually do get more done. They found out it's true. You get more done. So if you're a multitasker, well done. Here's what they also found. The brain must divert major resources in order to concentrate on concentration. You follow me? Instead of concentrating on the task you're doing, your brain is drawing resources to concentrate on concentrating. And you know, the first places that it draws energy from are learning centers and the memory. So what that means is, if you're a student and you're studying, and you're listening to the radio, and you've got a text message up, and you've got instant message going on, and you're also surfing the web, and you're checking blogs, and your roommate's talking to you, you are now multitasking, you're dividing everything up, and what you'll do is you'll be able to get an A on that test, and your brain will have learned nothing, and you will not recall what you learned. That's what we're discovering is happening. So what it's causing is, in fact, you may wonder how many, you know, when the guy says, they may wonder how many of you there really are, that's true. There may be more of you, but you may be a whole lot smaller than you thought you were. We get more done, and we become smaller people. We become fractured, fragmented, and scattered. So if the goal is to get more done, then you should become a ninja with all of the requisite tools to become a perfect multitasker. But understand, you become anemic spiritually. You become fractured and fragmented. And so the real practice is learning how to focus long enough to actually expand who you are and deepen who you are. Multitasking does the opposite. And the cell phone has a natural spiritual bias for multitasking. It is baked into it. I know this stuff, and I have an iPhone, which, by the way, up until Christmas, I didn't have one, and I had all this street cred like I'd never had a cell phone before, so I could come and talk to people like you and be like all holier than you all. And then my wife got me an iPhone, and I'm like, this is so awesome. There's no way I'm getting rid of this. So now I have an iPhone, right? So what I've realized is, even though I know this stuff, even though I talk about this stuff and study this stuff, I have to be deeply mindful of its power to shape me. I want to comfort it and coddle it and be with it and nurture it like a child because it's so cool. But I have to develop discipline to gain distance enough so that I continue to expand and remain present. Okay, are you with me? You see this? Good. Here's the biggest problem. This bias towards multitasking and this race against time, because time is money, and money is what gives choice in the world. Here's the biggest problem. It creates in us a value. The highest holy value you could possibly have in this culture is efficiency. Here's why efficiency as a high value, as a spirituality, is a problem. Have you ever heard of efficient spiritual growth? If you have, run from it. It isn't real. How about efficient love? Does that compute for anybody? No. How about efficient wisdom? No. Doesn't exist. Wisdom doesn't come through efficient means. How about efficient peacemaking? Sorry, doesn't happen. Even efficient suffering. Efficiency does not go with spiritual development. And yet it becomes the dominant spirituality of our culture. The value by which we make meaning is efficiency. And here we are trying to deepen, evolve, expand, develop, ground, root in growth. And we're doing this value that goes against it. And the reason I put up efficient suffering is because suffering actually is one of the most important ingredients to a growing spiritual life. So let me just unpack this a little bit. If you've ever read an interview with a celebrity who started out being a celebrity as a child, one of the things they will report is that they stall out development whenever they became famous. And the reason is because the moment they became famous, all of the resistance in their life dropped away. They had all the money they needed. They had all the power they needed. They had adults waiting on them hand and foot, getting them whatever they needed. All of their suffering went away, and they froze in time. Resistance is important to the development of your soul, your spirit. There's a story of Russian cosmonauts who spent a year on an international space station. They worked out for 6 hours a day in a zero-gravity environment. When they came back to Earth, they could not walk for a month. Their bodies had atrophied. Their muscles had atrophied so much because there was no resistance. There was nothing there to work, contract, expand, and develop the muscles. And the same is true with our spiritual lives. And for some reason, our ability to engage suffering and not collapse and not fight, but to genuinely receive suffering, is one of the ingredients to a growing spiritual life. Now, it doesn't mean that suffering equals a spiritual mature person. There are plenty of people who suffer and don't evolve at all. So it's a necessary but not sufficient condition for our growth. But the point is that everything about our digital and technological age is about escaping from that, is about running from that, is about moving faster, 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 so that you don't ever get caught up. Nothing ever catches you. And so the spirituality of the cell phone is to cause us to flee from suffering. By the way, we flee naturally from suffering anyway. We don't need any help. But the cell phone is a way to help us. Are you bored? No problem. You've got the internet. Are you lonely? No problem. Call somebody. Boredom. Loneliness. Are you anxious? No problem. Distract yourself. You've got a game. All of these things are there at your disposal to ease that kind of suffering, and yet those are the very things that expand us. Okay. There is another bias of the cell phone, a spiritual bias, and I have two ads that I'm going to show you that are paired right next to each other that I want you to walk through. Watch. Oh, sorry. Got to go through this again.
Hi, Daddy.
Hey, sweetheart. I miss you.
I miss you too.
What did you do today?
I played soccer.
For your most important calls, reach out on the wireless service America trusts, AT&T Wireless.
Okay. There's a dad. He's lonely. He's dejected. He's traveling. He gets, all of a sudden, sitting next to him is his daughter. And he brightens up and beams. He's so happy to be with her. And then a passenger obstructs the view, and we discover that he's actually on a cell phone, and he is beaming as brightly as if she were just sitting next to him. Because we all know that it's just as easy to parent over the cell phone as it is in person. Am I right? Once again, the lie is in the visual gag, that somehow his joy, it is as if he were next to her. It is equivalent to being with her. So the truth is that, yes, in fact, it connected to someone far away. The lie is that that's equivalent of being together. Let me watch another.
Mike, Sue.
Yes.
Love and honor.
Yep.
Sickness, health.
Uh-huh.
Objections? Rings? Do you?
I do.
Do you?
I do.
Kiss? Husband and wife. Next.
I don't know about you, but anytime I saw that ad when I was watching this, I always had that like curious tilt of the head, like the RCA dog looking at the recorder, like, what? What is going on? What? How is that selling me on anything? Why would I want an efficient wedding? And I said that at one point when I was speaking, and someone said, I can think of a reason you want an efficient wedding. Think about the money, cost, anyone? No? Okay. You're not with me? Anyway, the point is, so this ad is selling efficiency, is it not? That's what it's selling. Again, one of the benefits of the cell phone. What it accidentally tells you, the truth that it tells you, is the deeper truth of cell phones, which is they separate those of us we are nearest to. So this is the simultaneous truth of the digital age. Yes, it connects you to people from far off places, but it also separates you from people closest to you. It disembodies you. So if I'm sitting with you at lunch and somebody calls me and I say, I'm sorry, I have to get this, and I pick up the phone, in that moment, I've left you. It separates us from one another. Those that are closest, we get separated from. This disembodiment has very powerful implications for our spirituality. Let me show you one other ad that sort of summarizes what that is.
Soon, people everywhere will set their own programming schedules. They will not be restricted by something as trivial as location. They are Generation Cox, and entertainment will follow them. No matter where they are. Generation Cox is coming. Are you ready?
Okay. Generation Cox is coming. Are you ready? No. Listen to a couple of the lines. Soon people will set their own programming schedules. They will not be restricted by something as trivial as location. They will not be restricted by something as trivial as location. Here's the story. The kid gets to have a mediated experience of his favorite penguin at the kitchen table in the backseat of his car. Then when he finally arrives to meet the penguin unmediated, what happens? He freaks out. He can't tolerate it. Now, the ad is doing a little play on stranger anxiety, a normal developmental thing that happens. It's cute and fun. What's funny about the ad is it accidentally tells the deeper truth, which is increasingly the digital age is causing young people who are growing up in it to be incapable of having face-to-face conflict. They're incapable of knowing how to relate to one another. Their social skills are being profoundly drained, degraded, dissolved. That's a very real thing that's happening. For them, location is trivial. Let me tell you why that is a lie. When I was a chaplain at UCLA Medical Center in California, I worked on the liver ward. The liver ward is where, basically, at UCLA, the doctor who wrote the textbook on liver transplants, he worked there. And so we had the sickest people from all over the world come there. So I got to see a lot of very sick people. And one day I walked into a woman's room, and I walked in. She was in her mid-50s, and she was yellow. Head to toe yellow. The whites of her eyes had turned yellow. And that's a condition called jaundice. It's usually a bad sign. It has to do with your liver. That's why she was there. She started turning yellow. She went to the hospital. Doesn't always mean bad things, but it can mean bad things. And so we sat there together and started talking. So, well, what are you in for? And she said, we don't know yet. We just came in, got some tests. We'll find out in a minute. She was there with her family, and she was hilarious and funny, and she made very clear she was not a religious person. She was an atheist. Thank you very much for your time. And I said, that's okay. You don't need to be a religious person. I'm just happy to sit with you for a bit. Okay. So we joke and banter and talk. I think she's hilarious. She's funny and fun. And suddenly the doctor walks in, which is rare. Usually when you're a chaplain, you don't get to see the doctor come in, but the doctor came in. She walked right in, and she said, well, we have your test results, and you have a 7-inch tumor on your liver. So I'm not a doctor, but I was in the hospital long enough to know that most tumors are measured in millimeters. 7-inch tumor is a bad sign. And the doctor said, it's in a place that we can't operate, and it's far enough along in its stage that no chemotherapy will help. So we'll be able to make you comfortable. And her name was Kathy. Kathy kind of listened to this and said to her, so what are we going to do? She said, we'll make you comfortable. She said, I can't give you a time frame, but maybe a month. So you'll make me comfortable. Yep. Do you have any other questions? No. Doctor walks out. Kathy turns to me, locks eyes, and she stares at me for what must have felt to what did feel like to me about 8 to 10 hours. Was probably about 8 seconds, but it was felt like an eternity. And she locked eyes with me, and she didn't say a word, and I looked back, and I didn't say a word. And inside, I'm going, whoa. She just got told she's going to die in a month. And she's looking at me, and I know what she's thinking. She's going, okay, chaplain, do your thing. I just got told I've got a month to live. What have you got for me? Now, I'm a person that's never at a loss for words. So I opened my mouth and I offered my deep, sincere wisdom, which sounded something like, that. And she then looked at her family, looked back at me, and said, can you give us a minute? And I went, yeah, yes, of course, absolutely, yes. And I got up and I left, and in that moment I went, ah, wow, you are bad at this. I mean, wow. Not only did you totally blow the moment, like your chance to offer some really compassionate, comforting, something really spiritual, and you offered nothing, not only that, you didn't pick up on the fact that she kind of wanted to be alone. I mean, could you not grasp that? Like, I just got told I'm going to die. I'm with my family. Do you mind? You voyeur? Like, why are you still sitting here looking at me? So I leave, and I'm like, gosh, I can't believe it. And that night, I couldn't sleep at all. I was just running through my mind, what could I have done? How could I have fixed that situation? How could I have been better at this? And I went and talked to my supervisor, and we worked up this whole thing. I'm like, well, maybe you go back, go try and find her, maybe sit down and just kind of acknowledge that it must have been very hard, and of course, it was a real shock to you, too. And, you know, just trying to find your way back into it, and so I kind of developed the script that I was going to use, and I walked back up the next day, and I walked into the room, and the bed was all made, and she was gone. And I did one of those, oh, thank you, Jesus, you're chalking it up to, Shane's an idiot, but I still love you. Yeah, I appreciate it. So I did one of those things. And then later in the day, I'm walking down another floor, and I walk by a room, and I hear a voice say, Shane. I stop, and I walk back in the room, and it was Kathy. They had moved her to another floor, and she said, Shane. And she looked at her family, and they immediately left. She said, Shane, come and sit next to me. And I walked in, a little bit anxious. So, yes, okay, so I got my speech prepared. I'm ready to do this. She goes, I've been looking all over for you. And I wanted to tell you that I cannot thank you enough that you were there for me during that time. Because in that moment, I knew I didn't have to think about anything, that you were taking care of it. To which I said, of course I was. That is exactly what I was doing. No, she sat there and through tears said, you made me feel like everything was going to be okay. In that moment, in that instant, I realized that location is anything but trivial. My presence in the room actually changed something. I said nothing. I wasn't even emotionally that available or present. I was terrified. And yet my presence somehow God used. How do you convey that in an email? Like just a blank page, send? Maybe that's it. How about in a phone call? I mean, is it just heavy breathing? Somebody know you're there? Don't try that when I tried it. It's very awkward. I don't want to talk about that. Soon they will not be restricted by something as trivial as location. That is the bias and the spirituality of the cell phone. And yet it works directly against the fundamental, deepest truth of Christian spirituality, which is the Word became flesh. Jesus came to be with us. Not in spirit, but in body. Jesus was fully embodied and walked with us. And we are the body of Christ. And the body of Christ is not just an interdependent connection between people that is the church. The body of Christ is to be the hands and feet, tangible, tactile, present in the world with people. You are not with someone over email. You are not with someone over the phone. You are merely a disembodied digital acquaintance at that point. So, the two most powerful things that the spirituality of the cell phone creates in us is a relationship with time and space that is directly the opposite of what is required to develop spiritually. The cell phone and the digital age demand that we run from time and that we flee from space. And yet every wisdom teacher in any spiritual tradition will tell you that being present in the moment and present in that location is at the heart of a growing spiritual life. Your capacity to be present in the present moment is hugely important to our ability to be an incarnate people, to incarnate Jesus. So I'm going to close with just one or two exhortations, then I'll open it for questions and comments. If you don't want to do questions and comments and you're wanting to do the coffee shop thing, we can do that. So we don't have to be here for a full hour. But let me just say this. I'm not against technology. I'm not against the cell phone. Obviously, I own one. I own one on steroids. What I'm interested in is us to develop an awareness of the impact bias of our technologies, of the same awareness we have of our food. Every one of us in here knows that if you eat ice cream every day, all day, you will get fat. You will become malnourished. You know that. Now, you may choose to eat a lot of ice cream, but you know it at least. What we don't seem to know is the power of our technology to shape our souls and to shape our relationships. So my interest is saying, do you understand, will you become aware of the power of technology to shape us so that you might have a more effective, healthy digital diet? For some of us, it may mean a fast from certain technologies, from certain entertainments, long enough to recalibrate the soul and the psyche so that you can re-inhabit that technology in a way that's healthier. But my primary interest is to say, how present are you now in this very moment? How present are you in this room, or is your mind elsewhere? How present are you when someone is yelling at you? How present are you when your wife is angry at you? How present are you when your kids are driving you crazy? How present are you when you're stressed out of your mind and you want to escape the world? How much can we absorb this moment? How fixated on the future are we? How much do we long for the past? How much do we fear the future? How much are we actually in this moment, the only moment that actually exists? The past doesn't exist. The future isn't here. This is the only moment that exists. Are you here? Thank you very much. You've been a wonderful audience. You guys are great. Questions or comments? Things you want to push back on? Things you want to go deeper on? Yeah.
Cross is an optimistic person. On what basis?
That's good. The question was, I did a workshop this morning, and apparently the impression that this gentleman has is that I'm presenting very dire situation, and yet I seem like an optimistic person. On what basis am I optimistic? Which is a good question. You know, look, I actually believe that our technological age is in many ways a phenomenal gift to us. But nobody needs help seeing that. We adopt all the technologies. It's just a part of our lives. We already know all the conveniences. So you don't need someone coming in talking about how wonderful technology is. It's the ground of meaning. It's the ground of being and the assumption of how we live our lives. What we need help with is understanding that there is an unintended consequence. So it isn't to say that there aren't wonderful, vast, incredible benefits. I'll give you an example. I was sitting in a car in Houston with my brother, and I learned that my mom went into emergency surgery. And seconds before that, my brother and I were able to call her. We each had an iPhone. We did a three-way conference call, and we prayed for her just before she went in. I then traveled to Arizona, where she was having surgery, at which point she came out and she told me, "All I can tell you is that when you prayed for me, I realized that I could do this." So there's a great gift. It connects people from far off places and does bless. So that, in a sense, I think there's great value and benefit. It's just that I don't need to spend a lot of time talking about that because most of you already know that. Second thing I'd say about our age is what we are experiencing now is merely greater and greater degrees of risk and benefit. That this age, there is more opportunity for great things in the world than there ever has been in any other time in history. And there is also more opportunity for horrendous, horrible, catastrophic things than any other time in our history. Both are true. The reason I'm optimistic is because I think God is optimistic. So I'm very hopeful that we'll be okay. My interest is just, let's become aware of it. Good question. Others? Yes. The two, for me, the most important, fasting from technology, I will, you know, periodically if I'm driving in my car, for example, I'll just make it a practice to not turn on the radio or anything and just drive in my car, which is, for me, difficult. I'm used to having something, music, a podcast, whatever. I'm used to listening to something or talking to someone on the phone or, you know, it's a chance to get something done, actually, now that I have a cell phone. And so my practice is to allow 10 or 15 minutes of nothing to get done and to rest in being in that moment because it's the only moment that exists. And that's where God is. Wherever existence is, there God is. And this is the only moment that exists. So right here is where God is. He's not after this. He's not before this. He was and he will be, but he's here now. So my practice is practicing presence, becoming aware of this moment, and trying to inhabit it. Another way that I'll do that is a method of prayer called centering prayer. So that's a practice where you try and gain distance from the stream of mind, the stream of thoughts. So our thoughts, our minds, are constantly stuck in the narrative of time. Your thoughts are constantly moving and breathing and thinking in your... It takes you out of this moment. Your thoughts are always taking you out of this moment. You're thinking about what just happened, thinking about what you got to do next. You're worried about something. What about the promotion? What about the economy? What about all these things that are going on? Part of the best practice I've found is a practice that gains distance from the mind enough that you simply watch it, but you're not a part of it. It's like being in the center of a cyclone, the center of a hurricane. It's whirling around you, but you're not in it. So that practice actually deepens, and it is the exact opposite of what the spirituality of our digital age does, which sucks you into the vortex and spins you around. Does that make sense? I mean, there are a million of other practices. Yeah, that's just one, and others that I do. Good question. Other questions? Yeah.
Just a question on, with the inundation of media and all those things, do you have any counsel for parents, but also for those of us here as pastors, on what guidance can we give in the developmental phase of children, middle school, high school, even up into college, be good stewards of technology, and also how do you work with it?
Because yeah,
it just comes in from the very time we're little children. What do you do with it?
Great question. First thing I would tell you is, and anyone who's got kids, is you don't need to teach your kid how to use technology. They'll teach you. So the best gift you can give your kid is very, very strong boundaries around technologies, because they are immensely powerful. And so the longer you can delay the introduction of technology into their lives, and digital media into their lives, the better it is for their development. The best thing you can do for toddlers, for example, is to not put them in front of a TV screen at all for any reason, including interactive computer learning games, including educational television programming. And the reason is because toddlers, their only job developmentally is to master gross muscle skills, coordination. So play with blocks, play with people, play with things, get them out of screens. Do not put screens in front of them. Bad for them. Teenagers, I know it's really, really hard. If you can profoundly limit the amount of time they have in front of a screen, it is good. They don't do a lot of passive watching TV. Their time in front of the screen is almost always interactive time. It is their social time. The problem with that is it is radically anemic, incredibly thin, stripped down social interaction that removes all of the things they need to develop most deeply in order to be social beings. So, for example, when I'm in front of you right now, you can see through me. Every one of you can intuit whether or not I'm insecure, whether or not I'm secure, whether or not I'm happy, whether or not I want to be here, whether or not I'm frightened, whether or not I'm whatever it is I am. You can intuit all of that without ever having to talk to me. You can just see me and gather the information. And teenagers are having to manage their social impression at all times. They're terrified, and it's a terrifying thing, quite frankly, to manage social impressions at a time when rejection is very high. And so kids have to learn that. What happens is digital interaction is much preferred because the rejection is so much less likely. And your ability to manage your impression is so much easier. It's also an inauthentic experience. If you look at MySpace as a great example, kids project an image that is quite frequently not who they actually are, because it's what they wish they were. So when you interact with them in person, they are not the gangsta that they think they are. They are not the like hardcore gangbanger they'd like to be. They're a nerdy bookish kid who doesn't want to be a nerdy bookish kid, who's full of love and God's grace and gifts. They want to be something else. And when you're that kid and you interact face to face in real social situations, you can't fake it. They'll see right through you. And so for teenagers who are trying to develop social skills and social interaction and manage your social impression, which are crucial to healthy adult functioning, lots of online interaction is not serving them well. After you get through developmental stages, it's okay to introduce pretty much any technology you want to introduce, because they've developed the foundations they need in order to inhabit those technologies. They're no longer overtly shaping them. They're still shaping us, but you at least have a foundation to work from. Does that make sense? So, I mean, we could go through a million examples of how and when to do that and all that. But I think the issue is one of the best gifts parents can give their kids is boundaries around these kinds of technologies. Other comments or questions? Yeah. That depends entirely upon what it is you're trying to accomplish and what your context is. So I wouldn't say there's any hard, fast rules on how much or how little you can use of anything. But what I would say is lots and lots of images hijack the imagination. So you want to use them very, very carefully, very judiciously, very deliberately. It's not to say you shouldn't use them. I use them sometimes. But you just want to be careful how they work. But otherwise, be intentional and understand how media works. For example, your lighting. Lighting is a medium. It's a technology. If you walk into a worship space and all of the lights are up, it means there's a spiritual bias for community. You're creating a situation in which you are not allowed to be anonymous. If you walk into a worship space and all the lights are down, It's a spiritual bias towards personal, reflective, contemplative, and anonymous worship, because no one can see you. It also means you're free to express in ways you probably wouldn't have felt if all the lights were up. So that isn't to say that one is better than the other. In fact, sometimes you want to do one and not the other, and otherwise sometimes you want to reverse it. But the point is that you understand that lighting actually shapes the spiritual experience of the room. So my interest is saying, do you understand what the technologies do and undo, and then use them accordingly? And that's the stuff I write about and work at in, you know, more detail. Good question. Okay, we've got about 2 minutes. Any other questions? Yeah.
If technology reverses the role of the generations, instead of the older ones teaching the young ones, what happens to wisdom in the community?
That's at risk. Wisdom is at risk for a couple of reasons. First, the information revolution does a great job at sticking us developmentally delayed. Like, we become developmentally delayed. Because what the information age does is it gives us information, but not actual understanding, and certainly not wisdom. So Google is a great tool for getting answers, but it's a terrible tool for developing wisdom. Because wisdom comes through patience, suffering, time, season, experience. Information, though, now that it's immediate, you bypass wisdom, and you kind of get stuck in what I would call the permanent puberty of the mind. The metaphor I use when I talk about puberty is this. When I was in college, when I was in high school, I should say, not grade school, let's say, a guy by the name of Travis Groth hit puberty before the rest of us. The guy, I think, by like 8th grade could bench 300 pounds. He was a monster. And when he hit puberty, he grew so fast and became so muscular that he lost all of his coordination. He just had muscle, and a lot of it. And when he didn't have coordination and he was on the football field, he was mostly a danger to himself. Eventually, Travis figured out how to coordinate his muscles. Then he became a danger to all of us. And I was definitely on the receiving end of that a few times. I did not know you could see stars. I thought that was in the cartoons. It's real. Eventually, though, by the time we got into late high school, Travis had settled down in his gift and realized that he didn't always need to use it. And in fact, he stopped being so abusive. And he realized that one of his greatest powers was to not use it and just have the threat of it. That became his development. I equate that with the stage of basically what it is to have lots of information or knowledge, what it is to have understanding, and what it is to have wisdom. So knowledge or information is just sheer muscle without the ability to coordinate or make meaning. And you're mostly a danger to yourself. The internet creates a lot of people who have a lot of knowledge without a lot of understanding. They're mostly a danger to themselves. Those people that develop enough fortitude to actually try and make meaningful connections with their knowledge might develop good understanding. And if they have that, they are mostly a danger to others. It is only when we develop wisdom that we know when not to use all of our knowledge, that we can be a gift of compassion and love to others. That's when we are best serve the world. And everything about our digital and internet age works against the development of that kind of wisdom. Because this immediate input of knowledge gives us the illusion of wisdom, and therefore we don't need wise elders to help us. So yeah, that's an issue. That's a concern. I don't think all is lost, though. I mean, I do think that most people have an intuitive sense that they still need wise people to help them with their knowledge. So I think there you'll still find that. I don't think it'll go away. I'm just saying, if we're not careful, it'll short circuit. We are done. You've been fantastic. We're going to carry on the conversation at the coffee shop. Those that are interested in continuing, I'd be available, and we look forward to it. Thank you all. You're wonderful.